Welcome back to Season 8 of Talking with Traders. This is the fourth year of this podcast since it began in 2020. Once again, IG Markets have come on board as the sponsor of this podcast. We're truly grateful and privileged to have such a global leader in CFD trading as our sponsors. In the coming weeks, I'll be interviewing various guests from around the globe on the topic of trading. Some of these will be past guests that we invite back onto the podcast, and some will be new guests. The idea is to attract a broad spectrum of different perspectives from players in different areas of the markets. None of what you hear here is financial advice, but it is intended to get you thinking about how you might be able to apply what you hear here to your own trading and investing. Remember to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast app. That way, you'll be notified when new episodes are released. Once again, thank you to IG Markets for sponsoring this podcast into its fourth year. And thank you, listeners, for your continued support of this podcast. Now let's get into this week's episode. Welcome back to another episode of Talking with Traders. And this time it gives me great pleasure to go across to the USA, to New England in the USA. And my guest today is Brian Feroldi. And he is very active on Twitter. Got over 500,000 Twitter followers, Brian. Very impressive. You've also got a very, very good YouTube channel, which I'm going to suggest that the listeners go and check out after this podcast. But welcome to Talking with Traders. I'm very excited to speak to you.
Oh, thank you for having me, Garth. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thanks. What really got me interested in interviewing you was really that you put out a lot of very, very interesting content on Twitter, or X as it's called now. And but you kind of go by the mantra of demystifying finance. And you do that phenomenally well. I mean, a lot of the content that you tweet out is a sort of personal finance stuff, common wisdom, but you know, common sense. But common sense is not always so common. And you kind of really dumb it down so that it's simple and easy to understand. And you know, after having looked at your Twitter feeds, I then went to your YouTube channel and I was more blown away because the content that you've got on there is really, really impressive with your partner, Brian Stoffel, who is also involved with you on these. So without, you know, dilly-dallying too much, because we've got a lot to speak about, and I normally try and keep these podcasts to 45 minutes, but I think we're going to run a little bit over that today. I'm allowing us up to an hour because I want to go through your framework and checklist for evaluating businesses. And sure. Before we start with this, I mean, I'd want to just say to the listeners, they should go and have a look at your YouTube channel, because on your YouTube channel, you go through this checklist in detail. The video is 1 hour and 20 minutes long. So you've got to invest a bit of time. You use Home Depot as an example of how you evaluate a business, but it's absolutely phenomenal. And it's actually a process that I will probably take into my own evaluating of businesses going forward. And I've been doing this for 20 years plus, but I think the way you look at it is, you simplify it. You don't need to have a CFA to go through the process. It's simple enough that a normal person without major financial qualifications can actually go through it and build a profile of a business, evaluate a business, and decide whether it is a worthwhile investable candidate or not. So with that in mind, we're basically going to go through your checklist today. And in a way, hijack that video. But as I say, users must go and check out your video as well. Essentially, you've got seven high-level categories that you look at when evaluating a business. So we'll go through each of the seven, and then so there are obviously little subcategories within each one. But let's start, Brian. I mean, the first one that you look at is what's called financial score. Just tell me a little bit about that. I mean, I know you've got pointers there, financial resilience, gross margin. Talk to me a bit about the financial score and where we go with that when evaluating a business.
Sure. Let's zoom out quickly, though, and just talk about why we have checklists in the first place.
Right.
So if you start investing in individual stocks, like I did, I subscribe to several Motley Fool services. And once you understand the process of discovering a business, it is you quickly become overwhelmed with ideas and good ideas for where to put your capital. And before I had this checklist that we're about to go through, I was effectively trying to keep everything in my head. And I would say, ooh, I like that this company has a high gross margin and is founder-led, but this company over here has a really wide moat and a high return on capital. And this company over here has recession-proof demand. And I was trying to balance these factors that I liked in my head. And finally, after a couple of years, I said, well, maybe I should write this stuff down and actually come up with a system that allows the thinking to actually be done external to my brain so I don't have to overwhelm myself when it comes to decision fatigue. So the checklist we're about to go through is essentially version three of a checklist that I've made over time. And this is something I have found that I've created checklists, I've shared them online, I've gotten great feedback from people, I've made new versions, and I've kind of updated this. So what we're looking at, what we're going to go through today is kind of the most recent and updated version of my checklist. But I highly encourage people, no matter what type of investor you are, to at least do the following steps. Step one is write down all of the business attributes or investment attributes that if a company had them, they would be a positive. You would be like, yes, I'm glad that this company has these attributes. Secondly, make another list that is all of the attributes that a company has that are negative. You don't want to see these attributes in a business. Third, force yourself to rank them, weigh them in order of most important to least important. And then fourth, come up with a simple scoring system that will allow you to take any investment you come across and go top to bottom and check out how close of a match that investment is for what you are looking for in an investment. That process will take you a couple hours to do. You can go to my website, brianfarley.com/checklist, and download a copy of the one we're about to go to as just like a rough starting point. But that process will free up so much mental space from yourself, and it'll make you a much better investor.
Very well said. Very well said. Okay, so with that in mind, we're going to go through the version three of your checklist, and as I said, there's seven high level categories that you kind of go through, and they have scores on each one, and then at the end there's a thing called the gauntlet, which is where you basically you've built up the score for a business as you go through the seven steps, and then at the end you go through the gauntlet, which is where you now start knocking points off if there are certain things that worry you about a business, right?
Absolutely. So,
Okay.
but to your point with that, let's start at the top. So, the scoring system that I have when it comes to adding points, the maximum score you can get is exactly 100. And I really recommend having an absolute number of points because if you don't have an absolute number of points in mind, it's really easy to convince yourself that some categories need more. And every time you're giving a point to a category, you are by definition taking points away from every other category. So it forces you to really focus in on the criteria that truly matter. So from a financial perspective, the first thing I look at is a category I just call financial resilience. This is essentially balance sheet analysis. I want to see, all things held equally, a company with a lot of cash and no debt, right? If a company has a lot of cash and no debt, it is in control of its future. And importantly, if bad times come along, or when bad times come along, that company's balance sheet will allow it to play offense, acquire businesses, increase sales and marketing at a time when its hobbled competitors are forced to play defense. So, number one is a strong balance sheet. Number two is gross margin. A gross margin is simply gross profit, which is revenue minus cost of goods sold, divided by revenue. And this expresses on a percentage basis how many pennies per dollar of sales does the company turn into gross profit. I think that gross profit is the most underrated financial metric that exists. So many people focus all of their attention on revenue and sales and pay no attention to gross profit, which is two numbers below that on the income statement. But gross profit is what pays the bills, is what pays employees, is what can eventually be used to reward shareholders. So I want a high gross margin. So I assigned 3 points, up to 3 points, if the gross margin is 80% or higher. If it's below 40% or below, I assign 0 points. So I want a high gross margin. Third, returns on capital. And for this, I look at three metrics primarily: return on equity, return on invested capital, and return on capital employed, ROI. So that's ROE, ROIC, and ROCE. Generally speaking, I want to see those numbers in the double digits, 15% or higher, for each metric. If a company has high returns on capital, then it has the ability to continually reinvest in itself at high rates, which will be a great sign for delivering future free cash flow and profits to the business. Third is I want to look at the company's free cash flow, not earnings, not net income, free cash flow. Free cash flow is cash from operations minus capital expenditures. And this is effectively the amount of cash that can be pulled out of the business and used to reward shareholders. It's a different metric than net income. And I want to see that a company has not only free cash flow, but that free cash flow is growing. That I assign 3 points to. And the
Right.
final number is earnings per share. This is earnings, which are net income, on a per share basis. And I want to see that the number is positive and that it's consistently growing over time. So if you add all of those categories together, of my 100 points, 17 are devoted just to the financial statements.
Right. Okay. So 17% out of of the score goes to financial score. Okay.
Yes.
And that was the first element of the seven that we're going to be talking about.
Yep.
Right. The next one is the moat. Let's talk about that. So a moat is like, you know, the name suggests, it's this boundary of safety around your business, you know, like a moat around a castle. Let's talk about that. You've got a couple of different categories here. What are the scores? Because this one I've noticed actually scores very high as a percentage out of your total criteria,
Yeah,
this
this is the most
moat.
confusing one when people look at my scoring system because of the way I have it set up, but
Yeah,
I don't
because
know how to set
it's
it up differently, so
right.
let me explain.
Yeah, because it's
So,
interesting. You've got quite high weightings on this particular section, right? But I'll leave you to tell me about it. Right,
yeah,
let's go.
which probably means I have a user input error, and it's a design error on my part. But here's the way that I think about it. So I want, of my 100 points that I have, I want 20 of them assigned to a company's moat. It is the most important category. I mean, Warren Buffett has a famous quote that it's not the how much a business is going to grow or change society that matters. The thing that matters for investors is the competitive advantage and the durability of that competitive advantage. So on here, I list the five major sources of competitive advantage. That's network effect, switching costs, cost advantage, intangible assets such as patents or branding, and then finally, counter positioning. Happy to go into details on any of those if you want, but I have different scoring for each of them because you can have weak network effects or you can have strong network effects. You can have a weak branding advantage or a strong branding advantage. And then the last category is the direction of the moat. I want a moat that is not only wide, but it is widening. So it doesn't matter to me what source of moat you have. The maximum that you can score in this category is 20 points. So
Right.
it's not that you can get even more points if you have a network effect plus switching costs plus an intangible. The score maxes out at 20, but I assign up to 15 points for the type of moat that a company has, and then an extra 5 points if the moat is widening or if it's stable.
Okay. All right. Super. Let's just go through those in a little bit more detail quickly. Network effects and product ecosystem. I mean, when I look at that, I immediately think Apple. It's
Yes.
got a product ecosystem. It's very hard. Once you're an Apple user, it's very hard to do anything else. You know, if you've got an iPhone, you're likely to buy an iPad and a MacBook, etc., because the ecosystem is all integrated. And to change that is a hell of an expensive exercise and not very appealing to do. That's a moat, right? That's an example
That would
of.
be it. So there are two categories there. Essentially, a network effect is when one additional user adds value to the network for all remaining users, right? The classic one there is a telephone. If there are
Okay.
two telephones in the world, how valuable is a telephone? Not
Yeah.
very valuable because you can call one other person. Right. But if there's 100 telephones in the world, suddenly one person can now call 99 other people. And that is way more valuable. And if you have 1,000 or 1,000,000 or 1,000,000,000 telephones, each additional user makes the telephone more useful. So that's called a network effect. We see
Okay.
that often in marketplaces, so where people buy and sell together, like eBay or even a stock exchange. We see that with social networks like Facebook and Pinterest, right? The more users they have, the more useful it is for all additional users. We see that in some cases with cybersecurity, with the CrowdStrike. The more users it has, the better its product gets because it has more detection points. So there's a
Right.
couple different categories of them. Product ecosystem, yes, the classic case there is Apple, but there's also other companies that benefit, like Axon Enterprises, which is a small company that makes tasers. They make tasers that, like, you take you down. Their
Yep.
product actually integrates with other products, such as a body camera, such as
Okay.
software that police officers use to network it together, such as local 911s. So those products actually all talk to and communicate with each other. So
Okay.
that's, again, for a much smaller company that actually has an ecosystem.
Okay, very, very interesting. Switching costs, I think, speaks for itself. We know that I think is easy enough. Intangibles. How do you describe intangibles when it comes to the moat?
Yeah, intangibles is just a broad category for something that the company has. Intangible just means it's something that exists, but you can't touch it. You can't physically touch it. You can't touch a company's brand, right? You can't
Right.
touch the name Tiffany's. You can't touch the name Google. But do those brand names have value for those companies? Absolutely, they
Yes.
do. Other
Yeah.
types of intangibles could be a government license. For example, in the United States, there are, in order to operate a casino, you need a government license to do so. You can't touch a license, but does that have value? You bet that it does. That could also be patents if you're a pharmaceutical company. It could be trade secrets if you're a company like Coca-Cola. So there's a couple broad categories that are in there, but it's something intangible that you can't touch that gives the company a permanent advantage.
Okay, fantastic. And then counterposition. This one's interesting for me. What does that mean in your language?
Counterpositioning is the newest one that I've discovered. And counterpositioning is when a company adopts a business model, adopts a business model that is different than incumbents, and the incumbents actually can't compete or struggle to compete with that new business model because they would have to give up revenue in order to do so. Let me give you a real quick example. Netflix versus Blockbuster. In the
Right.
beginning, both companies were renting DVDs, exact same output. However, Blockbuster did it with physical retail locations you would go to and you would physically take the DVD. Netflix did it through the mail. That was
Okay.
a complete, and by subscription, completely same product, different business models. For Blockbuster to effectively compete with Netflix, it would have to shut down its retail empire, give up all of the revenue related to late fees, which is how it made the bulk of its profits, and switch to a subscription model. Could it have done that? Yes, but that would be extremely painful. And it would take gusto on part of the management team. They'd have to blow up their business model in order to compete. So Netflix at the start did not have a competitive advantage from switching costs or network effects, but it had counter positioning, and that
Right.
made it effectively impossible for Blockbuster co to compete with it.
Right. When I think of that now, because I was also trying to think of examples in preparing for this interview, I think of a company like Uber as well, right? I mean they've gone in and totally disrupted the taxi industry, as you said. That's counterpositioning, isn't it? In a way,
Absolutely.
they've got an app
Uber has a
and
number of advantages. I would say the network effect there is the biggest, where
right.
you want to use the platform that has the most drivers, and the most drivers want to go on the platform with the most riders. But do they have counter positioning against taxis? Absolutely. Uber doesn't own any vehicles. Like, how is that for a completely differentiated cost structure?
Yeah, amazing. All right, and then the last point there, as you said, is that moat direction widening, and that's obviously that also speaks for itself. Is it becoming harder and harder for competitors to get across the moat to eat
Yes,
into their lunch? All right,
absolutely.
okay, cool. So we've got two of the categories covered so far: financial score, which gets 17 points on your scoring system, and then the moat, which gets 20 points on your scoring system. The next one is potential, right? Potential, you've got optionality, organic growth runway, top dog and first mover advantage. Let's talk about these quickly. I mean, optionality, talk to me about that.
Sure. So this category has 17 points in total out of 100. So it's another big important one to me. Effectively, when I'm making an investment, I want to know that that company has the ability to continually grow its revenue, its gross profit, its cash flow for decades to come. The only way to do that is to have some type of opportunity in the business that will allow it to do so. So the first one there is optionality. Optionality, I define as the ability of a company to launch new products and new services that open up new revenue opportunities that are big enough to move the needle at the company. So a classic example there would be just what Apple has done over the last 20 years. Apple's big revolutionary product was the iPod. And then they turned the iPod into the iPhone. And then they turned the iPhone into the iPad, and then they took that operating system and they made the Apple Watch and Apple Arcade and all these different products from there. So they took their existing platform, they launched new products, and that opened up new revenue opportunities that actually helped to drive Apple's top line higher over time.
Okay.
See the same thing with many successful businesses.
Yeah.
Amazon started with books over the internet, and what do they sell today?
Everything.
Everything, right? Like everything. So
Yeah.
that was a company that had tremendous optionality to launch new products and new services to their existing customer base. And that allowed them to grow effectively, continually.
Right. And I guess they've still got optionality to grow.
Absolutely.
Thinking aloud, I don't know if they could, not that they'd probably do this, but I mean, with the clientele, they've got millions and millions of customers. I suppose they could go into anything if they wanted. If they wanted to start selling financial products or life insurance or anything like that, they've got the ability to do it, right? They've got the customer base.
Well, just
That's
within the last
optionality.
5 years, we've seen them go from having zero advertising revenue to billions in advertising revenue. And now customers actually pay Amazon for prime placement when customers do searching on their website. That's a whole new business that is essentially hugely high margin for the company that didn't exist 5 years ago.
Right. Okay. And I mean, I guess that leads us on to the next point in this section, which is organic growth runway. So you can
So,
organic growth is basically, growing your revenues from within. It's the opposite of acquisitive growth, right?
exactly. So I vastly prefer it when companies grow organically, meaning they are selling homegrown products and services to a growing base of customers. Growth by acquisition is a strategy that can work, but by and large, studies have shown that the vast majority of acquisitions don't work out. The purchase price is too high. There's cultural clash when two companies come together. There's management issues that can happen. And generally speaking, acquisitions destroy far more capital than they actually build wealth. There are plenty of exceptions. You look at companies like Berkshire Hathaway and Danaher and Constellation Software. There are companies that have grown successfully through acquisitions, but by and large, I personally value organic growth far more than I do acquisition growth.
Okay, completely get that. And then top dog and first mover advantage in an important emerging industry, disruptors.
This would be a new market is being developed, and when a new market is being developed, you want to bet on the lead husky. And by the lead husky, it's not the innovator that matters. It's not the first to market that matters. It's the first to nail product market fit,
Right.
right? So the classic there would be Facebook, right? Facebook was not the first social network. I think it was like the ninth social network.
Yeah.
So they weren't the first to market. They were the first to nail product market fit. Google was like the 12th search engine. Google was the first to nail product market fit. So once you identify the lead husky that has nailed product market fit, that's who you want to bet on.
Right. Always makes me think of that analogy that it's the second mouse that eats the cheese.
Exactly. Yes.
Right. You don't have to necessarily be there. I guess Tesla is another example, right? They weren't the first electric car company. Lots of
Right.
others had tried it before, but they nailed it.
First to nail product market fit.
Yeah.
Yep.
All
And
right.
that could be just purely related to timing, Right. If you look back to the 2000s, there was a lot of ideas that just completely failed in the 2000s, but they are now successful businesses. There was a company called WebRun, which was grocery delivered to your house, which completely failed. Now we call that Instacart.
And it's a part of everyday life for most people in the
Right.
developed world now. And operating leverage ahead. That's the last point on this section.
So operating leverage is a difficult concept to understand if you don't understand financial statements well, but by and large, companies have two types of expenses: fixed expenses and variable expenses. Operating leverage talks about the relationship between those two numbers and a company's revenue scale. To make things very simply, when a company has operating leverage ahead of it, that is the ability of that company through margin enhancements to grow its profits at a faster rate than revenue. So, if a company is growing its revenue 10% per year because of operating leverage, it should be able to grow its profits 15 or 20% per year. Now, the operating leverage is a one-time thing that happens. And so once a company goes through the operating leverage phase, its profits won't grow at faster than revenue forever. But I like to invest in companies that have operating leverage ahead of them as opposed to operating leverage behind them.
So I guess companies that have operating leverage behind them are often more mature businesses, right? Whereas your
Correct.
Yeah, so
Yes.
whereas your ones that have got operating leverage ahead of them are still growing, there's lots of room to potentially trim the fat and what have you to create that operating leverage.
As a very simple shortcut, if you come across a growth company and that growth company has a price to earnings ratio of 100 or higher, one potential reason that that exists is because the company has not yet experienced operating leverage yet. And the PE ratio, if a company has not experienced operating leverage, the PE ratio is worse than useless. It is a number that will give you false signals. So if what I just said confuses you, study operating leverage.
Very interesting. All right, super. So that's three of the seven factors covered. The next one is customers. And is this 10 points in your scoring
10
system?
points in total. Effectively, what creates shareholder value is over the long term is happy customers, returning customers. Customers are the lifeblood of revenue, and revenue is the top of the income statement. So I want to know what is the relationship between the company and its customers. And there are two things that I look at. First is customer acquisition cost. How expensive is it for a company to attract new customers to its platform? If a company has to spend like crazy on sales and marketing to get a customer, that's unattractive to me. I want companies that attract new customers through the lowest cost marketing there is, which is word of mouth, right? So a company that's growing through word of mouth is way more valuable to me as an investor than one that is spending like crazy on sales and marketing to grow.
And then dependence is the next point you said in this section.
Yep. So th this is a question of how does the customer buy from the company regardless of economic conditions? So I want to invest in companies that have recession-proof demand, right? I'm going to be buying electricity and toilet paper no matter what is happening in the economy. But am I going to take a vacation if the economy's bad? Am I going to remodel my house if the economy is bad? No. So that would be cyclical demand, which I don't like. I want recession-proof demand. That is much more attractive.
All right, fantastic. So that's customers. Now, next one, number five out of the seven, company specific factors. And here you've got recurring revenue and pricing power. So I guess that recurring revenue in a way talks a little bit back towards the dependence we were talking about a moment ago. Do customers keep coming back and buying product from your business?
Yep, and I could have combined these two actually together, and maybe I should in the future. But yeah, there are two other factors that I look at. When it comes to recurring revenue, I want to know about the business model. Is this a company? Is the relationship between the company and its customer, is it a one-off transaction that happens every couple of years? Like, how often do we buy a new car? Like, maybe every 3 years, maybe. That is not recurring revenue. That's a one-off transaction that can be delayed. By the way, that's not that great. Whereas conversely, if I'm paying my cable bill, or if I'm buying cups of coffee from Starbucks, that is a repeat purchase. That's happening continually throughout the year. And recurring revenue is something that I prize very highly when I'm looking for an investment. The second category there is pricing power, which is how confident am I that that company can raise prices and without getting any customer deflection at all? How strong is the relationship between what the company can charge and a customer's willingness to pay? If a company raises prices a little bit and customers immediately look for an alternative, I don't want that. I want a company that can raise prices and have no change in demand.
Okay. All right. So I'm thinking just off the top of my head as we're talking here, a company like Rolls-Royce, and I'm not talking about the cars, that belongs to BMW. The Rolls-Royce, the aeroplane engine manufacturing division of that, right? Recurring revenue, yes, because those engines need to be continually serviced and you can't have it done anywhere else really. And pricing power, yes, because there's nobody else to do the work, right? They have pricing power in that recurring revenue stream. Am I thinking right about that?
I think you are. Yes, that's not a business that I know well enough to comment on, but like in the United States, I would say a company like Costco. Costco charges like $55 per year to shop there, and then you get bargains all year long. If Costco charged $60 per year or $65 per year, its customers wouldn't bat an eye about paying that increase. I mean, they might notice it when they actually do it, but nobody's going to give up their Costco membership because of a few dollar price increase in their annual subscription.
Right. Okay. So it's quite inelastic demand is what we're
Exactly.
effectively. And what's the scoring total? This company specific
10.
factors, 10, right? Another 10 points. Okay. So that's the fifth category that we're talking about out of the seven, right? Number six is management and culture. And I like this. This is kind of now getting a little bit more into somewhat softer issues. Soul in the game. What's that all about?
Yeah, so management is very important to me, and I assigned a total of 14 points to this. So soul in the game means that the CEO of the company, the company that's making the decisions, they care more about the company and the customers and the mission than they do about their own compensation. Many people that take that CEO chair are effectively hired guns. They don't really care about the company or the customers. What they are there for is to maximize their personal compensation. Now, some of them can do a fine job of doing that, but by and large, I want somebody at the helm that cares deeply about the reason that the company exists in the first place. This is why I favor so heavily founder-led companies, because if the founder took this idea from an idea in their head to a publicly traded company, that person has more money than they'll ever need in their entire life. And if they still want to go through the arduous process of running and operating a publicly traded company, that's not because they're driven solely by money. They are probably driven by some other factor. So think of Elon Musk, right? Say whatever you want about Elon Musk. He could have retired 25 years ago. He was fabulously wealthy, but he put all of his wealth and his time and his reputation into Tesla. And he went when they're having problems, he sleeps on the factory floor until that problem is fixed. I don't think the CEO of Chrysler would do the exact same thing because
Right.
that is somebody without soul in the game.
Right. Okay. Very interesting. Insider ownership is the next one. This refers to what just directors and CEOs, what percentage of the company they own, how many shares they have in their own right. Right.
This is effectively this is a tricky one because on the one hand, on the one hand, you want a manager that own as an owner operator. You want if that stock goes down, you want the CEO to lose millions of dollars of net worth. You want them to be hurt financially 1,000 times more than you're going to be hurt financially. So you want to be sure that your incentives are aligned, and one way to ensure that your assets are aligned is to make sure that the CEO and the management team have ownership of the business. Now, this can be tricky because if you operate a massive $100 billion company, it would be unreasonable to assume that the CEO owns like 5% of the stock, Like that would be $5 billion. If they're the founder, they might, but if they're a hired gun operator, that would be not realistic to have. So I look at two things. One, the percentage ownership, and I like to see 5% or more. But if that's not available, I like to look at what is the dollar value ownership. And if a CEO like Tim Cook, I think when he became CEO, they gave him $100 million worth of stock, which was like 0.001%. So on a percentage basis, that's not much. But I can guarantee you that a huge amount of Tim Cook's personal net worth is in Apple stock, and that gives him incentive to want to see it go up.
Right. Okay. Then Glassdoor ratings. I hadn't heard of this term before. That's something in the US, right? It's a explain it.
Yep.
Whatever
So
that is.
Glassdoor is a company in the US. There's other ones like Indeed or LinkedIn.
Okay, I
And
know
most
Indeed,
companies
yeah.
are employee rating companies. Effectively, what you want to find out is what do the people that matter most, the employees of the company, what do they think of the management team? What do they think of the company culture? All things created equal, I want to invest in a company that has happy employees that love the CEO and recommend that their smart friends work there with them. And I don't want to invest in company employees that are disengaged, that hate the CEO, that are saying, avoid this place. That's going to make it very hard for that company to recruit top talent moving forward. So I want to have some indication, not from the CEO, that the company is a good place to work.
Okay. Glassdoor ratings is what it's called. And is that information freely available on the web to
Yes.
anybody? Okay.
Glassdoor.com is a
Glassdoor.com.
go-to, but Indeed also has it. And Glassdoor is like the gold standard, but Indeed also has company ratings. So you
Okay.
want some type of rate. Like if you read through a 10K, an annual report, every management team ever says, we believe our relations with our employees are good, right? It's like, oh, like what else are you going to say? Oh, we think our employees hate working here. Like, no, nobody's going to say that. So you actually want to go to the source and see what they say.
Okay. All right. Very good. And then lastly, mission statement. I like this one, but you talk about it.
So, I used to believe that mission statements were corporate fluff. I thought that they were nonsense words that were requirements by the HR team. I've since changed my mind, and I want to invest in companies that are on a mission to do something beyond make money. So I want to invest in companies that have a purpose, a sense of being, and many companies, most companies, when they were founded, were started with an actual purpose. So the best example here is that Taser company I was talking about before. They're called Axon Enterprises. Their mission statement is incredible. It's three words: to protect life. They want to create products that minimize the chance of anybody dying, and it specifically relates to law enforcement. So they make non-lethal products that help to minimize accidental murders effectively. Like that is why the company exists, because the co-founder the founder of the company, one of his friends was murdered when he was younger. So he started the company to effectively stop that. That is a mission-driven company. And when you have a mission, when you have a North Star, it makes decision-making incredibly easy up and down the organization.
Right. Fantastic. Okay, brilliant. Then the last point of the seven is stock. And this is where we'd actually look at the shareholder or the actual shares, the performance of the shares. Have there been, are there share buybacks, friendly actions going on? Well, let's talk about this. The one point you had here is, has the stock beaten the S&P 500 over a long period of time?
So I want to invest, all things held equally, I want to invest in companies that have already beaten the market. Already beaten the market. The reason I want to do that is by and large, winning companies tend to keep on winning and losing companies tend to keep on losing. So I want to see a history of that company that I'm looking at already creating value for shareholders over time. So if a company has beaten the market, and by the market, I judge the S&P 500 over the last 5 years, or at the very least since it came public. That's a very positive sign to me. If it's lost to the S&P 500, if it's a losing stock, that is a bad sign to me.
Okay. All right. So you want that momentum, that outperforming momentum. And then shareholder friendly actions. I presume this refers to share buybacks, dividends, that type of thing.
When a company is creating profits, there are numerous things that it can do with those profits. It can pay off debt, buy back stock, pay a dividend, build cash, make acquisitions, or invest internally. I want to see signs that a company is not only producing money that can be used to reward shareholders, but they're taking some action to actually reward shareholders. So this is a broad category because previously I said, oh, I want dividend payers. But there's lots of companies that don't pay a dividend, but they reward shareholders with like stock buybacks, or they're paying off their debt. So this is just a broad category. Is the company doing something with its capital that rewards investors?
Okay. Interesting that, because I think there is this misconception that, you want dividend paying companies. That's not always the case. In fact, often your highest dividend yielding companies are the ones that are going to give you the worst performance in terms of capital growth over the long term, often because they're just too mature, or they're not managing the, not managing their shareholding correctly. So yeah, so it's interesting. There's so many other ways that management can do friendly actions on behalf of their shareholders, other than just pay dividends, which is good to know. And then lastly is consistently beating expectations in this category.
So in the United States, every 90 days, companies report earnings to Wall Street, and they report revenue and earnings per share. And each quarter, analysts put out estimates for what those numbers are going to be. By and large, companies that have a history of exceeding their targets are highly likely to continue exceeding them moving forward. It's in that company's DNA. And the reverse is also true. Companies that consistently miss their estimates are highly likely to continue missing their estimates moving forward. And to me, outperformance in the market comes from companies that set expectations low and then consistently outperform them. So I want to look back at the history and say, is this a company that consistently beats its estimates, or is it a company that consistently misses its estimates?
Okay, so basically under promise and over deliver,
Yes,
essentially.
exactly.
And how many points does this section get allocated? I mean, we could work it
11.
out, I guess, but there's 11. Okay. So there we have it. Seven sections that you look at when building up your score to 100. So the first is financial score, gets 17 points. The moat gets 20 points. Potential gets 17 points. Customers get 10 points. Company specific factors get 10 points. Management and culture gets 14 points, and stock gets 11 points, and that gets you to 100. Right. So now we've built it up, right? We've gone through all of these things. We've built up a score out of 100 based on all of these criteria that we've talked about. Now we get into the gauntlet. And this is an interesting. So now you're going to start knocking points off that score for various different things. So let's go through each of them one by one. First of all, is accounting irregularities.
If a company says you can't trust our financial statements, I take off 10 points. I should probably take off 50 points because I don't ever want to invest in any company that I can't trust the numbers. If I can't trust the numbers, then about half of my checklist is basically completely invalid, right?
Right.
So to me, if you say we have to restate our financial statements or don't trust these numbers, you're dead to me.
Okay. All right. Good. Customer concentration is next.
So I don't like investing in companies that get a majority of their revenue from a few key customers. I want companies that have millions of customers and they get their revenue from all different sorts of places. The reason is I don't want a single customer making a single decision for any reason to blow a hole in my investing thesis. So in the past, for example, there have been many companies that supply products to Apple. Right? They are a big Apple supplier and they build a key product that goes in the iPhone. And Apple represents literally 80% of their revenue or more. And what that means is that if Apple, for whatever reason, decided we don't want to use this supplier anymore, look out below. Like the entire thesis for the company gets blown apart and a huge chunk of its future revenue, it disappears. And those companies can literally drop 80% overnight for something that may have been completely outside of their control. So I don't like investing in companies that get more than 20% of their revenue from a single customer.
Okay, makes sense. Industry disruption is next.
So this one is a little bit more theoretical, but I don't want to invest in companies that are actively at risk of being disrupted by some emerging market tech or problem. For example, if you looked at this checklist in like the mid 2000s, Blockbuster might have looked pretty good, right? It might have scored pretty well, but you could see signs of an industry disruption happening with streaming coming along, and that would be a big threat to the company down the road. Now, I believe you would have had plenty of time to kind of see the writing on the wall before you, so you could have actually gotten out. But if a company has something about that company's industry is actively being disrupted, that's a turnoff.
Outside forces.
So this one is one I learned the hard way. I don't want to invest in companies that are reliant on some outside market force or outside market price for them to be successful. A real simple example there would be commodity prices. If you drill oil, if producing oil is your business, you could be the best oil driller in the world, but if the price of oil falls 50%, your revenue is going to fall 50% as well. So not only are you the oil driller dependent on your own internal capabilities and your own skill, but you are completely dependent on this outside market price, the luck of the price of oil in order for you to be successful. There are other companies that are like this. They only do well when interest rates are low, or they only do well when the economy is really strong. So those are outside forces, completely outside of the company's control, and you need that luck to go in the right way for the investment to work out. If I see that a company is heavily dependent on some outside force or outside market price, minus 5 points.
So you want them to be rather be a price maker rather than a price taker,
Bingo,
effectively.
exactly.
Then big market loss. And here you say, has the stock lost significantly against the S&P 500 at any time in the last 5 years?
So, or since IPO, effectively, this is very similar to the performance of the S&P 500. If a company has kind of kept pace with the S&P 500, but lost a little bit over time, that's not that big of a deal if I believe the future is looking bright. But if a company has a history of destroying huge amounts of shareholder capital and has been a massive loser since it came public, I take extra points off for that.
All right, super. Binary event coming.
So if I see that there is a legal ruling that could be yay or nay, and the outcome of that legal ruling blows a hole in the company's investing thesis, or if a pharmaceutical company has a patent and that patent is expiring in a couple of years, that would be a binary event, like yay or nay in the upcoming years. And if that goes the wrong way, if it blows up the thesis, I'm not interested.
Then extreme dilution.
So this relates specifically to stock-based compensation. In the United States, a lot of companies, especially tech companies in California, pay very high stock-based compensation rates to their employees. The cost of that stock-based compensation is dilution. I'm okay with a little bit of dilution if the company is growing rapidly. But if a company is diluting its share count more than 3% per year, I start to deduct points from it. And if it's deduct and if it's going if it's dilution rate is more than 5% per year, I deduct even more points from that rate.
Then growth by acquisition. This is the opposite of what we were talking about, organic growth runway before. It's growth by acquisition,
So this is a degree as well. So some companies make bolt-on acquisitions, small acquisitions. I'm completely fine with that. If you're doing $1 billion in revenue and you're buying like businesses for like $10 million, no problem, zero issue, right? Because go to zero, and it doesn't really matter that much. But if you are consistently buying acquisitions and those acquisitions are driving the majority of your revenue growth, then I start to subtract points.
Complicated financials. This
If
is
my head hurts, I'm very well
financial
versed in accounting.
gymnastics.
If my head hurts after I'm reading your financial statements, too hard, pass.
Simple enough. Antitrust concerns.
This would be for the tech giants out there. If they are regularly in the ire of the government and there's calls for them to be broken up, negative points in my point.
Right. Okay. And then headquarter risk.
Yeah, this and the next one can be combined. Headquarter risk and currency risk.
Currency
There
risk,
are
yeah.
some companies out there that are headquartered in parts of the world where there's just conflict. I mean, so many companies, there are lots of companies that are tech companies in the US that are headquartered in Israel. And that is just, that didn't seem like that big of a deal 6 months ago, but
Yeah.
it's a much bigger risk now. So I have very strong home country bias. I like to invest in companies that are headquartered in the United States that also get the majority of their revenue from the United States. That neutralizes the currency effect and the headquarter effects. Now, that
Right.
doesn't invalidate any investment, but I will subtract a few points for that.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And I mean, I guess anybody who was invested in Russian businesses 2 years ago learned that the hard way.
Exactly.
Suddenly the investments became zero overnight, basically.
Overnight.
And I guess it's the same reason why a lot of Chinese businesses are valued what is seemingly very cheap now. A lot out there look at China and say, well, the valuations are it's a bargain, right? But you're taking big country risk there, right? The
Yeah, the market
regulators
is not
there
dumb.
can,
The market is pricing them that way for a reason, because there is a potentially a binary event ahead. If the Chinese government said no more foreign investors, okay, good luck to you.
Yeah, exactly. Then suddenly your investment's gone. Good luck. All right, Brian. So that's it. So we've gone through all of the seven factors that you use to build up a score of 100, and then we've now talked about the gauntlet where you knock points off if any of those criteria that we've just discussed come up as red flags. Amazing. I mean, I love this. But listeners to this podcast, what I really, really recommend is that take this as a taster and go to Brian's YouTube channel. Your channel is just, it's just your name, right? Brian
Correct.
Feraldi. Yeah. Go and have a look and look at that video, which you, as I said, it's 1 hour and 20 minutes long, but it's 1 hour and 20 minutes of time, very, very well spent, which will flesh out this a little bit more for you and help you to evaluate businesses in a very, very methodical and very common sense way. Doesn't require you to have a CFA or to be, of significantly superior intelligence. You can really, really do some solid homework just putting this checklist to work. So Brian, that's it. I mean, we've done well. We've come in just under an hour, which is what I wanted to do. So thank you so much for your time. This has been fantastic. I think it's a treat for the listeners. And I'm very glad I discovered you and got you onto the podcast. I really, really do appreciate your time. And lastly, I suppose when we've talked about your YouTube channel, where else can listeners to this podcast follow your work?
Yep, I'm on Twitter, Brian Feraldi. I'm on LinkedIn, Brian Feraldi. I'm on Threads, Brian Feraldi. Or you can go to my website, which is longtermmindset.co. So whatever your platform is, I'm probably there.
All right, brilliant. Well, go and check it out. It's because you really, I mean, I know I complimented you at the beginning of the podcast, but I just want to do it again. The way you present the information on all of your platforms is very, very easy to digest. And it's just common sense, financial sense, which is what a lot of people really need. So well done and congratulations. And
Thank you.
thank you.
Appreciate that, Garth.
Thank you again for coming on the podcast. I really do appreciate it very much, Brian.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Thanks for joining us for today's episode of Talking with Traders, brought to you by IG, a world-leading CFD provider. We really are privileged to have such a leader in the field of online trading involved in this series. Please follow us on Facebook and engage with us there. And a reminder to make sure you subscribe to this series by clicking on the subscribe button on your favorite podcast app. If you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd also appreciate if you'd leave a review on the app too. Till next time.